This is Question Medicine 2019. Before we get into today's show, if you haven't done so already, please go to iTunes and leave a 5-star review. I cannot tell you how helpful it is. I promise it only takes 2 seconds of your time. If you're too busy to leave a 5-star review because you don't have 2 seconds in your day, I totally understand that. That's why you're listening to this podcast, so you can get medical education while you're doing other things. I get it. But if you could please tell one friend, just one friend, about the podcast prior to listening, it would be a huge help. Now, enough with the small talk. Let's get on to the details. Welcome back to Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. It is time to get in what I'm getting on. It is time to talk about what I'm reading about, and it is time to crunch through some articles quickly, briefly, succinctly, and with just enough detail to have you question medicine. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back, Question Medicine 2019. Let's kick it off. Let's get into this. I just got back from Raleigh, North Carolina, Chapel Hill area. Beautiful, beautiful town. I probably had one of the best meals I've ever had, ever. If you were in that area, or you're going to be in that area, and you want a recommendation on a restaurant, you can email me, andrewbuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. I'll hook you up with the details. Also, one of you astute listeners out there has been paying close attention. You have focused in on Question Medicine so intently that you know that I don't necessarily believe in vitamin D. And there has been a plethora of articles, especially in the last 4 or 5 months, out on vitamin D, and they have all been negative trials. And I have not talked about any of them because at this point, I'm only going to talk about a positive vitamin D trial. And even then, probably not going to talk about it because there's been so many negative trials. I mean, I'm just looking at some of the top ones. Vitamin D flops for diabetes prevention. They tried to put vitamin D and see, is it going to prevent you from getting diabetes if you had impaired fasting glucose? Nope, it didn't work. Did it work to prevent Alzheimer's disease? Nope, it didn't work. Did it prevent additional prenatal vitamin D? Did it reduce the risk of asthma and offspring? Nope, it did not work. Vitamin D, it just doesn't work. And I don't know why we in medicine, we being medical community, are so obsessed with this drug and why we want it to work so badly. If this was any other drug in the world, we would give it up on it by now. We would stop testing it in absolutely everyone and everything. But one of you out there, one of the listeners, I don't know if they want to say their names, so I'm not going to, message me about vitamin D and says, listen, I'm using vitamin D for this patient population that has PTSD or depression or anxiety or a psych condition. What do you think about the dosing that I'm giving? What are your thoughts? And here's, I laid out some of the evidence, but here is my overall general take on vitamin D. When I lecture about this, when I talk to people about this, when I talk to other providers about this, and this is hopefully one of the last times I'm ever going to talk about vitamin D because, again, the evidence, the proof of burden at this point is now on those individuals who believe that vitamin D works. If you don't believe vitamin D works, don't worry. You are backed by a plethora of articles. You don't really need to say anything other than just hand a stack of articles and say, okay, your turn. But those individuals that believe, it is now on them to actually come up with the articles that show benefit. But when I give lectures and when I talk about this, I usually say there is no evidence, zero, zip, zum, none, zincho, for vitamin D replacement. We know that a high vitamin D level is good, a low vitamin D level is bad, but there's no evidence for vitamin D replacement. There have been thousands of studies at this point, and the burden of proof is on the shoulders of those prescribing the medication. But with that being said, if you insist on giving vitamin D, if you believe that vitamin D works because it is beneficial in your patient population, in other words, the inclusion criteria for the studies is not the patient that sits in front of you in the office, then that's fine. And I can't argue with that. If you say that this is a different patient and this patient, I think it works, again, I can't necessarily argue with that. However, because it has not been shown beneficial. We do not know the correct dose. And the lab test is so expensive, we don't need to check their levels since no specific level of replacement has ever been shown beneficial. Just give the medication and forget about it. It's like a statin. Fire and forget. There is no need to recheck at this point. And that wraps it up. But, sidebar, if you do think that you do actually think that it works, you probably need to give at least 2,000 international units. And that, even then, is debatable. And there are certain studies that show that huge doses, like 500,000 international units, have been harmful. So, again, I don't think it works. I don't believe in it. But if you believe in it and you want to do it, that's fine. Just don't recheck. The test is so expensive. Don't recheck. Just give them the medication and move on. There's no evidence that says whatever you're doing is beneficial. The dose is beneficial. Give it up. Move on. Here we go. On to the first article we're going to talk about today. Here we go. And the first article is one that has us questioning medicine. Now, I've often said, and I actually always say, that there are two parts of medicine that have terrible research studies, and that is one, pediatrics, and two, obstetrics. The reason is no one wants to put their kid in a trial, and no one wants to put their pregnant wife or pregnant wife carrying their child into a trial, and pregnant mothers certainly don't want to be in a trial. So I get it. We don't have good evidence for most of this medicine, and if you think otherwise, then again, you can email me at andrewbuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. But This study out in the New England Journal of Medicine back in August 2018, labor induction versus expectant management in low-risk nulliparous or nulliparous, depending how you say it, women. Now, this did the unthinkable. The unthinkable in that we've often said in obstetrics, if you go to an early induction, then you're going to raise your risk of C-section. You're going to have a bad outcome for the child. So we are not going to induce you any sooner than necessary. Well, in this randomized control trial, they offered 22,000 women to be in the study. But again, no one wants to be in the trial. 63% decline. That only left 6,000 women. And they were randomly assigned to labor induction at 39 weeks or expectant management, which led you up all the way up to 42 weeks and 2 days. And what do you think that the outcome showed? Oh, you're probably thinking that there was no difference, because that's what I was thinking when I read this. But not only was there no difference in the perinatal harm, so baby was A-OK, the rates of C-section was 19% induction group and 22% in the expectant management group, meaning not only, and that was statistically significant, but that means not only can we say, is it not harmful? Not only can we say, are you not more likely to go undergo C-section if we induce you early at 39 weeks? You actually probably will be better off than if we just go ahead and let you ride this thing out to 42 weeks. I think that this is a game changer, or at least it should be a game changer. If the baby's ready to come out, then the baby's ready to come out. But if the baby's not ready to come out, don't worry about going ahead and pushing the drugs and doing this thing early, because it doesn't seem to be harm to the baby or to the mother in terms of C-sections. On to the next article. And while we're talking about really old articles, or at least old studies that I've read that have been sitting here waiting to break into the podcast arena, let's talk about this one also. August 31st, 2018, this is the viability in ejection fraction measured by echocardiograph, gated single photon emission, computed tomography, and cardiac magnetic resonance in patients with coronary artery disease and left ventricular dysfunction. Basically, here's what you need to know. They took 2,000 patients, and those 2,000 patients either all had a cardiac CT, this cardiac magnetic resonance, a echocardiogram, and they said, what is the comparison? If these 2,000 patients, they all get these studies, and the difference was within the last less than 3 days, equal to or less than 3 days, what is the difference in their ejection fraction? Ideally, it should all be the same. If these tests were 100% accurate, it would all be the same. Except it wasn't the same, because this test, just like any test, is never 100% accurate. There's always confidence intervals around every test and around every estimate that we get. This one found that the absolute difference between any two of the things that I mentioned, any two of them, was 6 to 7%, and roughly 25% of the time, there was a disagreement on whether the ejection fraction was less than or equal to 35%. That's a big deal because that's looking at heart failure. And if we don't have an accurate assumption on whether these people have or don't have heart failure, again, a big deal because the people that were in the trials had systolic heart failure. So if one test says, oh, this patient has an ejection fraction of, 44%, and the other exact same test on the exact same day says, actually, you're way wrong. This patient has an ejection fraction of 33%. The patient that gets the ejection fraction of 33%, all of a sudden, boom, bam, wham, beta blocker, ACE inhibitor, maybe an aspirin, probably going to load them up with statin, even though it doesn't really help in heart failure, and spironolactone. I mean, come on. Tests are not perfect. Medications are not perfect. But this just goes to show, I think, what we hopefully already know, in that when we're looking at the ejection fraction, again, it's a range. It's not a precise number. And speaking of things that are not precise numbers, let's move on to another article. Assessment of functional capacity before major non-cardiac surgery, an international prospective cohort study. This is in Lancet. And this was looking at the guidelines, the 2014 American College of Cardiology guidelines for the perioperative cardiovascular risk assessment before non-cardiac surgery guidelines. And in those guidelines, they say that if you are estimated, the clinician estimates you to be at high risk, equal to or greater than 1%, then they recommend, and that risk is based on how your meds are. Basically, if you're less than 4 METs, which is the inability to climb a flight of stairs, then they suggest that you undergo a pharmacological stress test. That seems reasonable. You have a patient in your office, they say, hey doc, I'm going for this non-cardiac surgery, and I can't even go up a flight of stairs without being short of breath. You say, maybe we should do a stress test to see, how your heart's doing, because surgery is a big deal. That seems reasonable. In the guidelines, it also says, only order the test if it will impact decision-making. Also seems reasonable. Well, in this study, they took 1,400 patients, and the clinicians estimated the patient's functional capacity. The patients then took a 12-question Duke Activity Index, which talks about how active they are, and they underwent a cardiopulmonary exercise test. They underwent a stress test. These people did it all, and then they went to surgery, and we looked to see what is better. I mean, all these people went to stress tests. All these people were evaluated by a survey. All these people were evaluated by a physician. What happened? Well, the 30-day incidence, the primary outcome of death or myocardial infarction, was 2%, and none of them, the poor functional capacity of less than 4 months, METs, the improper or low peak oxygen consumption during the stress test, was associated with the primary outcome. Meaning, it didn't really matter what you did before they went to the test, before they went to surgery. All that mattered was that 2% of them were going to end up at 30 days with death or myocardial infarction, and it didn't matter what we did. We couldn't tell which 2% that was going to be. It's sad, it's frustrating, but I think we can overwhelmingly say that we should not use METs to assess patients' risk factors. And if we are, then we're doing it only to pat ourselves on the back, not because it's actually better for the patient. I don't think we have a right answer yet, but as any good paper will tell you, more research is needed. And speaking of more research, let's start off this next couple articles with going back to the SPRINT trial. That's right, the SPRINT trial looked at moderate cardiovascular risk patients, and then they're randomized to either intensive systolic blood pressure treatment, less than 120 systolic blood pressure, or a more lenient blood pressure treatment, systolic blood pressure of less than 140. Now, the primary outcome, or the thing that shot around the world, was the 1.2% absolute difference in mortality at 3 years. However, some of you will remember, and I was also screaming, I don't know if this is good. Maybe their mental capacity will start to wax and wane because they're getting less blood flow to the brain. There is a reason we call it essential hypertension. That's because typically, it's essential. In that same sprint trial, there was an increase in number of individuals who had new chronic kidney disease. And this, again, I was screaming from the mountaintop saying, look at this, new kidney disease. We can say that, yeah, sure, maybe they didn't die, but they're going to go on dialysis. And what kind of quality of life is that? I don't think so, Scooter. Well, in this study, Annals of Internal Medicine, titled Kidney Damage Biomarkers and Incident of Chronic Kidney Disease During Blood Pressure Reduction, a Case Control Study. Now, this looked at that exact situation, and they looked at urinary biomarkers of kidney damage at baseline and at 1 year in matched sprint patients with and without chronic kidney disease. And sure enough, patients with incident chronic kidney disease in the intensive group, so people that got intensive therapy and then developed chronic kidney disease, actually had declines in their urinary biomarkers for kidney damage. This is suggesting that it's not actually the decline in the blood pressure that's causing the kidney damage, but likely this is just a hemodynamic effect rather than true kidney damage. I'm not sure if I'm a full believer on this, but I do have to say that the evidence coming out of Sprint was quite impressive. And I don't think, as a sidebar, I don't think that Sprint is for everyone. I don't think everyone should be at a systolic blood pressure of 120. But it's kind of counterintuitive, because if you're high risk, if you are a high risk individual, if you are the Honda, the hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic, then you are super high risk and you probably need your blood pressure at a systolic of around 120. But those are the exact patients that I think we're probably, or at least I'm probably, not being aggressive enough with, because I say, ugh, I don't want to push their blood pressure low and have them fall and break a hip and blah, 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 blah. I make up excuses. But I think I can officially say, with all the literature that's come out, those individuals at the highest risk need the most care, not only the most care, but the most attention and the most medications to get their blood pressure to a low enough standard, or at least close to a systolic of 120. And the other reason I'm saying that is because I also, when the Sprint trial came out, was saying, I don't think so. This lowering of blood pressure, that's just going to lead to a mild cognitive impairment. We're not getting blood pressure to the brain. Well, I can't say it any longer, because the Sprint minded investigators for the Sprint research group, effect of intensive versus standard blood pressure control on probable dementia, a randomized clinical trial, out in January in JAMA. This was the Sprint investigators. This was the Sprint investigators looking at their data, and they were saying, what kind of effect does lowering the systolic blood pressure have on dementia or any mild cognitive impairment? Now, they looked at this, and over the course of a median 3.3 years, there was no significant difference that emerged between the intensive group, again, 120, and the standard group, again, 140, in the incidence of probable dementia overall during the time period. It was about 7.2 to 8, or roughly 7.5 cases per 1,000 person years. And that was just for cases of true dementia. If you looked at the differences in mild cognitive impairment, it was 15 per 1,000 patient years in those individuals randomized to intensive therapy, and 18 per 1,000 patient years for those individuals randomized to the standard therapy group. So this goes completely against what most of us were saying, and the fact that not only does lower blood pressure not, absolutely not, cause dementia or mild cognitive impairment, it appears that letting your blood pressure rise up a little bit higher might actually cause mild cognitive impairment. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-escaping. Again, there's multiple errors in the Sprint trial from how they did the blood pressure cuff, with the person or provider not being in the room, or no nurse being in the room, just a machine. And so it would run multiple cycles. And is that what you're actually using in your clinic to test patients? Probably not. However, I think that the evidence speaks for itself, and we should probably get the blood pressures a little bit lower than what we're probably doing, at least on those high-risk individuals. And if your concern is kidney disease, and if your concern is cognitive impairment, well, then have no fear. I think that if we for sure can't say it's better, maybe we can say it's better, but I think we can likely, based on these results, say it's definitely not worse. So prescribe away, my friends. Prescribe away. And we'll do one more trial, and then I'm going to bounce out of here like a basketball for game 6 of the NBA Finals. And this last trial is in gastroenterology, risk of postpulpectomy bleeding with uninterrupted clopidogrel therapy, and in industry-independent, double-blind, randomized control trial. Here's what they said. Basically, it's always a dilemma. The patient is on clopidogrel, and what do you do? What do you do? The patient wants to go with a colonoscopy. Maybe it's an emergent, maybe it's an elective, but what do you do? What do you do with the clopidogrel? Do you start it? Do you stop it? Do you keep it going? Do you not keep it going? Do you stop it for a day? What do you do? Well, in this randomized double-blind trial in Hong Kong, not necessarily my patients here in the United States, but I think that we can translate these results. The investigators did elective colonoscopies on almost 400 patients who were receiving clopidogrel. And then patients were randomized to either stop taking their clopidogrel for 7 days before the colonoscopy, and then they were either given 7 days of clopidogrel, their medication they were taking, or placebo, and they didn't know which one was which until the morning of the colonoscopy. And then right after the colonoscopy, they were allowed to resume their normal clopidogrel. Now, polypectomy was performed in 216 patients with almost 450 polyps found, and cold resection techniques were used for about 43% of the resections. Now, the clopidogrel and placebo groups did not differ in their cumulative or total incidence of delayed post-polypectomy bleeding. That's the ones we care about the most. The patient's coming back and saying, I am bleeding like you would not believe. Holy moly, you got to go back in there and stop that thing. Or the immediate bleeding. There was no difference. Or the cardiothrombotic events. All of the bleeding events were successfully treated with the scope. I think this says pretty wide and clear that if you want to do an elective procedure, clopidogrel probably doesn't need to stop. We can keep it going, and that's okay. Whew! With that, let's wrap up this episode like we've wrapped up every one before it. And here we go, a quick summary in 30 seconds or less. Let's start from the top. Vitamin D, I personally don't believe in it, but if you do, that's okay if you think your patient falls outside the inclusion criteria of the given billion studies we have out there. But let's all agree that we don't need to check the lab value anymore. Just go ahead, fire, and forget. And if you're pregnant, don't worry about going under induction at 39 weeks. It actually seems to be probably more beneficial in terms of at least C-section compared to riding this thing out all the way to 42 weeks or 41 to 42 weeks. And if you are getting a cardiac test of any kind, or you're ordering a cardiac test of any kind, you got to know that all tests have variability, including cardiac tests. So when they tell you that ejection fraction is 43%, there is a confidence interval that surrounds that, and it's probably not exactly 43%. And if you're ordering that cardiac test because of a patient going to surgery based on the 2014 guidelines, well, have no fear. That evaluation is basically worthless. We have no idea, based on judgment, test, assessment, or anything, on what patients are going to end up with a bad outcome at 30 days post-op surgery. We can follow the guidelines all we want, but more research is needed. And when the SPRINT trial first came out, I was screaming, more research is needed on this. There is no way that we should immediately follow this. However, now that I'm looking at it, this does seem to be the end-all, be-all, or at least the next change in medicine, if you will. Maybe not the end-all, be-all, but kidney disease, the lower kidney disease, the increase in kidney disease seems to be just a transient little movement. There is not actually a worsening in the urinary biomarkers. I know that's just a surrogate marker for actual end organ damage. However, it seems to be an effective one, and it probably does not give you true kidney damage. And if you were worried about cognitive decline or dementia, well, so was I. And it appears that lower blood pressure actually is protective of the brain. It goes against everything I know, and maybe I'll need to go back to physiology to read why is that so. But again, it doesn't seem to cause cognitive decline with the lower systolic blood pressure. And last but not least, if your patient is undergoing an elective colonoscopy, elective meaning they're getting screening, then you can probably keep the clopidogrel. And if they're undergoing an emergent colonoscopy, well, then you should probably stop the clopidogrel because they're probably bleeding out, and that's why you're doing the emergent one. So there you have it. There it is. That's a wrap. Closing this one down, just like we've done every single podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning. Hey folks, before I get to the music and I really close this thing out, if you like today's show, please go to iTunes, leave me a review. It just really helps the way the podcast is brought up for other people to view. And if you don't want to leave a review because that takes too much time, then I totally understand. But do me a favor and tell one friend, just one friend, about the podcast and have them listen to it. Again, it really helps bring up the podcast for other people to find. Now, let's finally end this thing like we've ended every podcast before.